As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. President Trump has been impeached for a second time, this time with 10 Republicans joining the effort. But even with this bipartisan vote, many Republicans seem eager to move on without punishing the president. The Speaker of the New Hampshire House, Republican Sherman Packard, who doesn't get a vote on impeachment, says, quote, "It bothers me when we start placing blame." So how best to move forward when both sides push opposing and irreconcilable ways to heal? And what is your take on the reaction to what happened in Washington, D.C. on January 6th? And how may it ripple through New Hampshire culture and politics? Call us now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can use Facebook or tweet us at NHPR Exchange or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. With us to discuss the week in the news, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Dean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter. Good to be with you.
And we've also got Jasmine Ulloa, national political reporter, 2020 election reporter for the Boston Globe. Jasmine, welcome.
Hi, good morning.
So let's start by hearing a little bit from Governor Chris Sununu. He spoke this morning with NHPR's Rick Ganley. And first we'll hear a question from Rick, and then we'll hear the governor's response. Here is that question.
You know, this week you called rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol, quote, domestic terrorists. You also said that President Trump bore some responsibility for contributing to that violence with its rhetoric. You did stop short of calling for his removal, saying that was up to Congress. But now that the House has voted to impeach President Trump, do you agree with that decision?
In terms of my decision, in terms of my statement that he had responsibility. His words carry a lot of weight. I think his leadership, our words always carry weight. We have to be careful of that. And obviously, led to folks, coming down Capitol Avenue there and entering what in a situation that just wasn't appropriate. It was beyond not appropriate. It was appalling. We sat there shocked while these individuals, these domestic terrorists, attacked our nation's capital, and it was completely uncalled for. And of course, the president has to take responsibility in that.
That's Governor Chris Sununu speaking this morning with NHPR's Rick Ganley. Jasmine Ulloa, how does that response strike you?
That's interesting. I mean, we heard from a lot of rank and file Republicans on the House floor condemning the actions, condemning the violence, and yet refusing to hold the president accountable. So it's interesting to hear that, I guess he seems to be backtracking there a little bit about, at first not wanting that accountability, but now saying that he does need to be taken into, that he does need to face responsibility for his actions. So that's interesting that he's moving away from not calling for that in the first place.
And Dean Spiliotis, what's your reaction? How does Sununu's comments fit into the national Republican dialogue about this?
Yeah, it was a little unclear from that clip exactly where he is on literally impeaching the president. He clearly was very critical. Kind of sounded like he supports impeachment, but I think he's using the being a governor as a way to not have to weigh in literally on what Congress decides to do. And he's already in a position where he's already getting it from both sides. He's had pretty significant criticism from the right wing of the Republican Party here in New Hampshire on his handling of the pandemic, his use of emergency powers. He has been increasingly openly critical of President Trump, particularly on the pandemic, and Democrats are going to continue to criticize him, even if he does eventually come out in favor of impeachment. It's hard to describe the Republican Party with a single picture of where they are in this. There are a number of individuals who were quite supportive of overturning the Electoral College results in Congress, and some of those individuals have now been quite critical of President Trump, but stopped short of calling for him to be convicted in a Senate trial after impeachment. There are others who are still quite firm supporters of President Trump and who prefer to talk about other issues related to the Democratic Party. And they mention Antifa, and they still mentioning China and Ukraine and Hunter Biden. And so and then there are, as we know, a small number, 10 in the House, who voted in favor of impeachment, 10 Republicans. So it's kind of hard to paint Republicans with a single brush stroke. I think we're seeing some real internal fissures in the party, and I think that's gonna carry over into a discussion of where the Republican Party goes in the future. Their party, you know, all the public opinion data we're seeing this week suggests that President Trump is still very popular with the base of the Republican Party, and I think that we've seen a number of Republican members of Congress kind of test the waters of putting some distance between themselves and President Trump. But I still think everybody is kind of trying to read the tea leaves on this in the Republican Party.
Right.
And I think Governor Sununu is in a similar position. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely more to see on this question. It's not going away anytime soon. We heard from Speaker of the House Sherman Packard as well on this. I quoted him at the start of the show, but I do want to hear in depth his response to what happened on January 6th. So here's what he told NHPR this week.
Nobody has the right to do what happened down there, to break into the United States Capitol, which is sacred ground as far as I'm concerned, and damage it and frighten the people. And it was just absolutely unexcusable. Who's to blame? I have to say that it bothers me when we start placing blame.
And Dean, as you mentioned, typical of some Republicans, not all, I don't want to paint that broad a brush, but some Republicans, as soon as you start looking for blame, will say, well, what about Antifa? And that is exactly what Sherman Packard did in this interview.
Peter, it's pretty clear from that clip, and again, I didn't hear the entire interview with him, but it's pretty clear from that clip he's in a different place or a different group within the party than Governor Sununu. He's holding more closely to the traditional support for President Trump.
Yeah. Well, we're taking stock of a busy week in American history today on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we want to know from you what you make of lawmakers impeaching President Trump for a second time and what you hope to hear from New Hampshire lawmakers and leaders of both parties. Give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email your comments or questions to us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Jasmine, I want to turn to you because you were there on the scene in D.C. and you wrote a first-person account of what it was like for the Boston Globe. You and other Boston Globe reporters reconstructed the events of the day. We've got a link to your story on our website, nhpr.org, by the way. Jasmine, what stays with you most from last Wednesday?
Yeah, you know, I think it's anger at not knowing just how much danger we were in at that moment, because it was so confusing. So I think as more evidence has come to light, I think it's been more frustrating for us, for those of us who were inside and were trying to rush to safety, trying to find a safe place to hide. I also feel like I can't even answer that question yet, because it feels like that moment isn't over. I feel like we're still very much living it, and everything that, you know, I've been hearing from.
What do you mean by that, Jasmine? As the nature of trauma, or as just we don't have all the factual information to report on it yet?
Both. I mean, we don't have all the factual information. The trauma still feels very, very much with us, not just personally, but I think with the nation, and what I keep hearing from national security experts, historians, congressional leaders, you know. Lawmakers who were in their offices sheltering or in these secure, you know, safe places sheltering. The thing I keep hearing is we're in a very fragile and critical moment for our nation. And so I think that we still have a lot of questions here that aren't answered, and we're going to be fighting to have answered.
Yeah, and one of the questions that you were pursuing in your reporting is what members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation understood about security at the U.S. Capitol before January 6th. What were you told about what they were told?
Yeah, members received multiple assurances that they would be shielded from the masses, that they would have the crowds under control. One member of the delegation actually walked the premises with Capitol Police and received assurances from Capitol Police DC police and even some officers with the Supreme Court saying that they would have everything under control, that they had protocols in place should the crowds get too large. Representative Ayanna Pressley, who has been in the, you know, direct line of fire vitriol from President Trump, was one of the members who was, you know, most concerned about this because she's been receiving death threats, you know, for the past 2 years to her and her family. So this was very, very serious. And again, you know, the, you know, her chief of staff had personal relationships with some, with a lot of the officers in security detail for these very reasons, because of these threats. And she told me, you know, that Sunday I started calling people, I started phone banking, I started getting all the members from my staff ready, prepared for this, told people to stay home, similar with Jim McGovern. So I think everybody was very, very surprised that they were able to get into that building, because it's very hard to get into that building with the right badge. And so to get into that building, nobody thought that they would get into that building, much less, you know, get into the second and even third floors of that building.
Mm-hmm. And so there will be investigations about the nature of the security, the defenses that were put up. What can you tell us about those investigations and whether or not there is a partisan angle to them?
So the House Committee, the House Administration Committee is pursuing bipartisan work on this, bipartisan investigations into the security breakdowns. And I think there is bipartisan support for some of the other investigations as well. Jason Crow, Representative Jason Crow has also called for the Government Accountability Office to pursue wide-ranging investigations, as well as the Inspector General of Capitol Police. And they're asking that they not only look into the security breakdowns, but also the roles the roles that members of Congress and even some Capitol Police officers might have played in assisting the mob, because we have had some very startling allegations in the days since then. You know, from representatives who saw Republican members, or actually they didn't specify, but they did see colleagues, is the word they use, colleagues, leading very large groups of people through the Capitol the day before, in which Mickey Shrilly, she's a representative, former Navy helicopter pilot, called them reconnaissance tours.
And we don't know the nature of those yet. I mean, I don't know how routinely tours like that are given. It could be something that you know, members of Congress do for their constituents all the time, or it could be something special. We don't know yet. Is that correct?
Right. We don't know yet, but they were so out of the ordinary that a group of lawmakers reported it to the House Sergeant of Arms the day before.
So, okay. So there were some indication.
Peter, but we do know that since the pandemic, the Capitol has largely been shut down. So
exactly.
It is a little bit unusual. It is a little unusual to see anybody other than members of Congress and staff, you know, walking through the halls of Congress. So to the idea that these people were getting tours is certainly at least, you know, that obviously have to find out what the circumstances around them were, but it's certainly worth looking into, given the timing.
Sure, certainly. Thank you very much for that insight, Dean. And Dean, how significant is it, in your view, that 10 Republicans voted in favor of impeachment?
Well, it's, you know, historically speaking, it's the largest number that we've ever had vote against for impeachment against a president of their own party. It was 10 individuals in 1998 with Bill Clinton. Five Democrats voted to impeach a Democratic president. So it's the largest number. It's probably not as large as some Democrats would have liked. You know, it shows that there's still a pretty strong level of support for President Trump within the Republican caucus. I mean, I think some of those folks are true believers, and other folks are just wanting to move on. But in any event, it's the most we've ever seen. What it bodes for the Senate, hard to tell at this point. The Senate trial is a very different kind of process. This was very quick. You know, it was a much, much quicker process than a year ago when we had the first round of impeachment for President Trump. So, you know, we'll see what it means for the larger environment. You know, there was some suggestion that, you know, there were some Republicans who wanted to vote in favor of impeachment, but they were concerned about their security or other kinds of ramifications. I mean, that's just kind of the nature of the situation that we're in now. So, you know, I think Democrats were probably happy to see some, you know, in particular, Liz Cheney, the number three person in the House leadership, member of the House from Wyoming, very strong anti-Trump statement when she said she would vote in favor of impeachment. So I think probably that alone, and perhaps Adam Kinzinger, who many listeners have probably seen on MSNBC or CNN, congressman, veteran from Illinois, he also was a very high profile no. And then there are obviously eight others. So, yeah.
And Jasmine, I'll turn this question to you. Dean mentioned that there might have been some Republicans who would have voted for the impeachment of President Trump were it not for some security concerns. To what extent are Republicans who did vote for the impeachment of the president concerned about their security or other kinds of negative treatment at the hands of perhaps supporters of the president, whether in Congress or outside of Congress?
Yes, I mean it's bizarre living in D.C. in this last year. It feels like we're living in a militarized zone right now. Just going to the Capitol, seeing the fences up, the metal detectors that have been placed there to protect the metal detectors in the House chamber have been placed there not to protect members from the public, but from each other. And you know we're hearing from congressional leaders that Republican Kevin McCarthy has actually been telling members not to call out their fellow colleagues by name because they are on such high security alert. There are serious concerns that people are going to be targeting not only Democrats but Republicans and Republicans that they see as quote unquote weak on these issues. In the days ahead of the inauguration, or on inauguration day.
Earlier this week, I spoke with Senator Jeanne Shaheen about whether there is value for a Senate trial even after President Trump leaves office. She said that there was value, and she also said that her fellow senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Josh Hawley of Missouri might face some kind of censure. She is on the Senate Ethics Committee and says that, you know, that would have to start with a complaint if the Senate Ethics Committee received such a complaint. But she says she wasn't able to disclose whether or not there was a complaint of any kind. Dean, what do you think? Is the Senate poised to deliver some kind of censure to senators who may have spoken out and repeated the president's false claims about a stolen election or an election that didn't have the integrity that it supposedly had?
I think it's certainly a possibility, and I think it's a more significant possibility in the sense that Democrats will control the Senate going forward, which certainly raises the ability to do something like that. This is really uncharted territory to have a Senate trial for an impeached president, but to have it after the individual is actually out of office. It sounds like now the earliest this could start would be the afternoon after, the 20th in the afternoon following Joe Biden taking the oath of office. It could take several weeks. And obviously the Biden administration wants to hit the ground running. So you may have this split screen where in the mornings they're working on Biden's, COVID relief package. And in the afternoons, the Chief Justice or the Senate Pro Tem, gavels the trial into order. So we'll see. I think, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, they've really had some significant pushback from donors and other media outlets in their home states. I think you'll see some attempt at censure. And again, I think all of this is more doable because you're going to have Democratic control of Congress. But then obviously you run into concerns about, people arguing that this is as President Trump has said, that this is a partisan witch hunt. That'll be part of the political polarization.
Yeah. And Jasmine, your thoughts, what do you think about the Biden administration trying to get some policy ideas through Congress while also managing a Senate impeachment trial? Can the administration do both?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that he's been navigating throughout, this whole rocky, turbulent transition period, trying to, name his cabinet members, trying to put together these plans. I mean, he just unveiled this 1.9 trillion coronavirus plan. I mean, these are the things that he wants to be talking about. And this is the frustration that I'm hearing from a lot of, Democratic operatives, Democratic lawmakers, that feel like these very important issues are getting overshadowed, as well as, you know, some of the things that should be that the party should be celebrating in the moment, such as the inaugural, you know, the election of the first Black woman, first person of color, first woman in to the vice presidency, and as well as you know, Biden has elected or has picked one of the most historically diverse cabinets in history, and they say, you know, these are things that we're not talking about and should be celebrating.
Yeah.
Well, on a process level, not only the, you know, public attention on the cabinet, but the need to get all those individuals confirmed. The
exactly.
confirmation process is off to a very slow start, and now so you layer that in on top of a trial and on top of a COVID relief package. It's a pretty complex set of issues to sort out in terms of allocation of time and attention.
No shortage of things for lawmakers to do, especially after January 20th. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And when we're speaking with our guests today about a wild week in the news, a president impeached, a nation stunned, and for some, political identities challenged. After a break, we'll speak with a prominent Republican from New Hampshire about his thoughts on the week's news. Tom Rath will join us, and you can too. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Roundup. Back in a minute. Monday on The Exchange for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we'll explore how King's words are being heard now after a tumultuous year and an increased push for racial justice. Right now, we're looking back at the week's news on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for tuning in. Our panelists today, Jasmine Ulloa, national political reporter, 2020 election reporter for the Boston Globe, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with us now, Tom Rath, an attorney and longtime Republican leader. He spent a decade as a state Republican National Committee man, served as a delegate to multiple Republican National Conventions, and was an advisor to the presidential campaigns of George W. Bush and Mitt Romney, among others. Tom Rath, welcome to the program.
Good. You tired me out. I hadn't realized I'd done all those. It's nice to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. You endorsed Joe Biden in the presidential race. Do you still consider yourself a Republican?
Well, I do. I'm not sure all my Republican friends agree with me, but yes, I do. I think that was a decision I didn't make lightly, but it was not a difficult decision. I consider yourself, you know, you can be a partisan, but you're American first, and you have to see what's best for the country. I think a second term, as the last 2 weeks have proven, of Donald Trump would have been beyond disastrous. And Joe Biden offered, and I think offers and promises, a breathing spot. He can get things, he can get people to work together, to sit down, try to figure out a way through common problems with common solutions. And I think that sort of practicality and just innate decency that he brings to the job made the choice pretty straightforward for me.
You mentioned some of your friends possibly not believing you are a Republican.
Well, you look at every time you lose an election, there's a lot of a kind of a purge goes on about who was purer than who. Right now, the Republican Party is not in a position to exclude people who want to be called Republicans. They need to try to make the party base bigger and more accepting and more tolerant of each other. And I suspect that will happen naturally. I don't think that I have much of a case that anybody really cares about. But the real point of it is we have excluded ourselves and gotten to an ever more restrictive, isolated part of the electorate. And that's the greatest prescription for losing elections you can find.
And have you been surprised, or is there another way to describe your reaction to the loyalty most Republicans continue to show despite President Trump inciting a deadly riot in the U.S. Capitol?
Well, actually, I think the answer, I guess, is no, because that is a loyalty not to the Republican Party, but to an individual. And that group of Republicans that have been, to their credit, committed to Donald Trump for a very long time, A, will not give up power easily, but B, you know, obviously feels the loss differently than a lot of other people do. I just don't see how, given what we've seen this week, which was clearly as close to sedition as we can find. I'm not sure I'm capable of parsing out the legal definition of it here, but how you can say that that is a path towards majority government for the Republicans is a calculus that I can't make.
Mm-hmm. We have a few days left in the Trump administration. To what extent are you concerned about what the president might do on his way out?
Well, I'm very concerned. And I think I'm a little less concerned every day that the calendar turns. It becomes a little bit harder. I think the events last week, I'm not sure they were designed, but whatever it is, whatever they were, it has really put people on guard and on notice. I also think that if the accounts that we're reading the last couple of days, including this morning, about the president's final days and hours in the Oval Office are true, they're not in much of a position to do anything right now.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the president's impact on the Republican Party, but I also want to bring in Governor Sununu's voice on this, because he did weigh in with NHPR's Rick Ganley this morning on the nature of the party after such a strong personality of a president. And here's what Governor Sununu had to say this morning.
Well, everything is always changing. Is the Democrat Party the same party it was when Obama left? No. No, look, I mean, does Bernie Sanders, do any of those individuals in Washington define the Democrat Party? No, I don't think so. I don't think Joe Biden defines the Democrat Party, and they shouldn't, right? It's about their ideals and their principles and where they want to bring government and that responsibility to the citizens, which is not always 180 degrees away from Republicans. That's the other issue we have. We tend to, everything wants to be black or white, right or wrong, agree or disagree. But in the real world, there's a lot of gray area there.
That's Governor Sununu speaking on NHPR's Morning Edition, saying that a party is about ideas. And while that may be true, it seems like the Republican National Committee this year, before the election, embraced the policy of Trump and not any specific policy idea. What do you make of that, Tom Rath?
Well, I think that's right. I served on that committee for better part of 10 years, and it was really interesting. And I served when we had a Republican president and when we had a Democratic president, and the ability of that committee, the RNC, to operate was really interesting, because in some ways the RNC was more powerful when we were not in office, because when you're in office, when you have a president of your own party, political apparatus tends to reflect that and be more a mechanism of the president than it does of the party. So the Republican National Committee is going to go through a change anyways, and I am very interested to watch what happens there. Right now, at the meeting in Florida a couple of weeks ago, Ronna McDaniel was reelected. I don't know how effective her service is going to be, because she's not going to have the White House behind her in two ways, either in terms of political support, more importantly, in terms of fundraising. And I'm not sure they're going to have the access to dollars that they had before now that Trump is gone. And that's going to inhibit their ability to do anything. I think the party operations, both the RNC and the DNC, are less significant when that party holds the Oval Office.
I see.
It just is a nature of it. At that point in time, the party is the president. And in our case, the party for the last 4 to 5 years, our party has been the Trump Party. And it seems to me the hole that has put us in with the electorate is going to require a lot more outreach and a lot more understanding of other people's views than simply, kowtowing to what Donald Trump thinks on any given moment or any given day.
And so how does that look from your perspective on a local level? How will New Hampshire Republicans move forward with that in mind?
Well, I think there's two questions here. First is on a political level. We have a Republican governor, and he is exactly the kind of Republican governor that I think New Hampshire has typically wanted. He is open, he is accessible, he is a good executive, and he listens and thinks about what other people say. Yes, he's got positions in Auburn, but he is an individual who is, by his nature, inclusive. The state party organization, which is different than the governor's office, has become really captive of the Trump organization, and the sort of prime credential for movement in the state party has been how loyal argue to Donald Trump. I'm not sure how fast that's going to change, but I can guarantee you that if it doesn't change, the party is going to get smaller and smaller rather than larger and larger, and our ability to win elections is going to be severely compromised. We are right now in the process of having kind of a circular firing squad, and until we put that aside and disarm and sit down and say, how do we win elections? We need to get away from that, because otherwise we're going to keep losing. Sununu's victory should be illustrative that you don't win by making the party smaller. You make it by broadening our appeal to the entire electorate of New Hampshire. And I think that's the message there. And I don't know whether people want to hear it, but that is the message.
Well, Tom Rath, attorney, longtime Republican leader, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed being with you. Take care.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're talking a little bit about the fallout from last week's attack by pro-Trump extremists on the U.S. Capitol and the impeachment for the second time of President Trump, which occurred this week. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. We've still got Dean Spiliotis of SNHU and Jasmine Ulloa, national political reporter for the Boston Globe, with us. And Jasmine, what do you make of the comments that Tom Rath was sharing with us about the nature of the Republican Party right now?
I mean, I think it's very interesting. I agree with a lot of what he said. I mean, that these are going to be, we're very interested in moving forward. We're going to be looking at the radicalization of the Republican Party, whether that, you know, whether that's just a generational thing, whether that's a grassroots thing, whether that's a disinformation effect.
Do you think Republicans are learning, to the extent that Tom Rath hopes they will, that the growth of the party, the success of the party, is going to rely on broadening the tent?
Those are some of the questions that we have out of this. I mean, even looking at the House Republicans who deflected on impeachment yesterday, it seemed like the party's establishment was trying to extricate itself from Trump's interests in the wake of the riot. But it'll be interesting to see what, you know, some of the younger members of Congress, some of the more rank and file members of Republican members of Congress haven't moved in that direction. They're still very Trumpian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter.
Dean, go ahead.
Can I jump in?
Certainly.
Yeah, you know, I've known Tom Rath for many, many years, and he has a strong attachment to the Republican Party. Other people like him in the party have left the party and become independents. Jennifer Horn is someone who comes to mind.
Former state party chair, now works with the Lincoln Project, which has really campaigned hard against President Trump.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time where she was a central player in the state Republican Party. And I think Tom did a really good job of describing where the party is now in the state. You know, Tom supported George W. Bush and Mitt Romney, two Republicans that President Bush has roundly criticized and even ridiculed at times. You know, if you follow Tom on social media, you'll see that he's been a very consistent and principled critic of President Trump. And, you know, the ideas that he raised about the Republican Party needing to broaden itself, after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, the RNC did a postmortem on their loss. And the postmortem said they need to broaden the party and make it more inclusive. And their party has moved in the exact opposite direction. So this is going to be the reckoning within the Republican Party that I was mentioning earlier. This kind of, some people like Tom had left, but others are still in the party, essentially struggling for control of its soul. And I'm not sure, you know, given what we've seen this week and given the still significant support for President Trump among some Republicans, how this is going to all play out. And I think Tom was right to question the RNC, and they're going to run into some real fundraising challenges, I think, in comparison to 4 years ago. But I think he did a really nice job of he really painted the tensions within the party, I think, very accurately.
Well, let me ask you about this other aspect of tension within the party, because WMUR is reporting that Republican State Representative Al Baldassaro is thinking of leaving the Republican Party if Senator Mitch McConnell supports convicting what will be by then former President Trump on the article of impeachment. He didn't say he'd become a Democrat. Baldassaro is a fervent supporter of President Trump, has been since the beginning of Trump's campaign. So where does that fit in, Dean? To what extent do you think the Republican Party, in order to broaden its base, needs to stop caring so much about what people like Representative Al Baldassaro thinks?
Yeah, you know, and at this point, you need a scorecard to keep track of all the various ideological bright lines that are being drawn in different corners of the party. You know, if politician X does such and such, I'm going to do the following and leave the party. And so, you know, Baldassaro leaving the party would be very different, obviously, than Jennifer Horne leaving the party. You know, I'm not sure what his long-term strategy would be. But as I said, you know, this is going to be the battle going forward. I think the short-term focus among Republicans is going to be to try to win back the Senate in 2022. But it's just going to be wild to see how the next round of presidential race, how the next round of the race plays out. Mm-hmm. You know, and hopefully, if all goes well, you know, we'll get to see it up close and personal. Right here in the New Hampshire primary for 2024.
We get this note from Robert in Epsom, who writes, ever since before Trump was elected, he's been spreading conspiracy theories, both that the ones against him were false and the ones for him were true. All of the coded and explicit language he has used repeatedly finally has the expected result, but there is often some minor fig leaf disclaimer language thrown in to provide plausible deniability. His supporters tout the minor fig leaf disclaimers and avoid the major message. There was enough to convict Trump on the first impeachment, so we wouldn't be here now. That's the comment from Robert in Epsom. Your comments, questions are welcome, too. Give us a call to join the conversation live on air. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email your questions or comments to exchange@nhpr.org. We get this note from Jordan in Boston, who says, we know that the Senate is flipping in theory as soon as Georgia certifies Ossoff and Warnock's respective wins. Is there a deadline for this? Is it the 20th? Once certified, how fast can they be sworn in, or will the chaos delay that? Jasmine, are you able to take this question?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Oh, the question is, is there a deadline for certifying Ossoff and Warnock? Is it the 20th? And how quickly can that happen? And will chaos delay their swearing in?
I think Dean should take that.
All right, throw it to Dean. What do you think, Dean?
Yeah, but to be honest, I'm not sure exactly either in terms of how quickly Georgia can certify this. I don't have any expectation. I mean, I'm not sure if this is covered by the 20th Amendment or not, which, you know, sets the schedule for the timing and all this. But I don't have any expectation that it'll be delayed in a significant fashion. I assume it's going to be, whether it has to be by the 20th or shortly thereafter, my expectation is it'll be pretty soon, but I don't know the exact
timing
in Georgia. Yeah, it's not something we've heard a lot of concern about. I think they're just basically have to run through a particular certification process in Georgia.
I see. Okay. And really quickly, Dean, what do you think? Does it seem likely that Democrats will come together and unify after the 20th? They will have, in theory, control of Congress and the White House, but are there fractures within the party that threaten to derail major pieces of legislation?
Sure. There absolutely are fractures. And if you look at the history of unified government, certainly over the last four or five decades, whenever a party controls both the presidency and both chambers of Congress, you start to see all kinds of internal fissures bubbling up within the party. It's a lot easier to unify when you're in the opposition. So, yeah, there are real tensions between progressives and moderates. You know, even though Democrats will have a working majority in the Senate, certainly with Vice President Harris to break any potential 50-50 ties, there's still the filibuster for legislation in the Senate. So we no longer have the filibuster for judges, justices, and cabinet officials, but we do still have it for legislation. So Joe Biden's going to need to get 60 votes on his COVID package in order to end debate and move to a vote. And so I think there's going to be pressure from progressives to do more. We saw that this package that he just announced has a $15 minimum wage in it, mm-hmm. which I'm going to be interested to see how that plays out.
Well, can I stop you for a minute there, Dean? Because I thought President Biden could, in theory, or Congress could use budget reconciliation to use a simple majority in the Senate. Is that possible?
Yeah, there's certainly one possibility. But my guess is they will attempt, at least initially, to kind of work through the normal legislative channels. And that's going to give a heightened, certainly within the Democratic Party, I think that'll give a sort of heightened leverage to people like, well, you know, Gene Shaheen or Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Mark Kelly, the new senator from Arizona. There are a number of moderate Republicans. There are also some moderate Democrats. There are also some Republicans, obviously Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and others. So for me, the big question going forward is for Joe Biden to get stuff through Congress, assuming he goes that route, you know, what kind of coalition? Is he going to work the middle or is he going to try to push something more progressive through using these other measures that you mentioned? And that's what I'm kind of waiting to see develop.
All right. Yeah, are we going to take a quick break, Jasmine? We'll pick up with you right after the break, because we're speaking about a variety of issues with respect to the political fallout in this incredible week of news. And listeners, what do you think the major political parties should be doing? Where are they headed? Is the GOP due for a split over Trump? And will Democrats maintain unity? Let us know. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're also going to get an update on the state's response to COVID-19. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're catching up on a busy week of news today, and we wanted to spend some time talking about the political ramifications. We've got Jasmine Ulloa, national political reporter, 2020 election reporter for the Boston Globe, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Listeners, weigh in with your questions or comments. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Before the break, Jasmine, we were talking a little bit about the political maneuvers that Joe Biden may have to take once he assumes office on the 20th to wrangle a few Republicans to support his major policy initiatives. Might be a tall order, but what do you have to say?
Oh, well, I was just going to add that, you know, I'm already hearing from some progressive lawmakers that say, you know, especially in the wake of the riot and the armed insurrection, that Joe Biden has a lot of leverage here to act boldly. So I think we are going to see, even now, as Democrats that have greater demands, you know, more progressive demands, are trying to navigate carefully right now in this moment, because, you know, they do understand the need for unity. But at the same time, I'm already kind of hearing, you know, the need for bolder measures moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And we get this note from Denise in Keene, who says, with respect to President-elect Biden's speech last night, laying out in detail his $1.9 trillion relief plan, she says, well, I'd say Biden did good tonight. It was a long road for him, filled with enormous challenges, loss, and missteps. Through it all, he seems he has chosen to take it standing up. Got to hand it to him and support him in the enormous job laid out before him in the autumn winter seasons of his life. Way to go, Joe. Relieved, comforted, and grateful for his leadership even before the inauguration. That's the comment from Denise in Keene. And let's also talk to another resident of Keene, David. David's calling from Keene. Thank you very much for calling, David. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm just calling to say I think we're doomed, because what was revealed in this last election is just how many, which was so close, just how many people are such a poor judge of character. Bruce Springsteen, predicted how this election would go, and that Trump would lose, and that he'd try to take democracy down with him. And that's exactly what he did. What else? Oh.
Well, David, we get your point there. I mean, certainly a lot of anxiety around how people have responded to this election. And D.C. is safe to say, not going to be the same for quite some time, Jasmine. I mean, how does D.C. feel now to you, Jasmine?
On edge.
On edge, yeah. As we gear up for the inauguration next week, a lot of people are worried about security.
Yes. I mean, like I said earlier, you know, there's fencing all around the Capitol. There's armed, you know, troops in fatigues in marble hallways underneath, you know, resting underneath 18th century paintings inside the Capitol building, the most iconic, arguably the most iconic building in the United States and a symbol of democracy. You know, we're having conversations in the Bureau about how we're going to cover this. We've ordered gas masks. We've talked about bulletproof vests just in case, because this violence that we saw on January 6th isn't new. You know, we saw it in Michigan, but I even saw it in Sacramento covering state politics for the Los Angeles Times just before, you know, a couple months before Donald Trump was elected. You know, there was a neo-Nazi rally right outside the state capitol. So this is something that's been this violence, this tension, this hate has been brewing for a while.
And the concerns about security are present in Concord as well. Governor Sununu was asked this morning by NHPR's Rick Ganley about what the state is doing to make sure that if there are protests this weekend, and it seems to be that there are some planned, that everything remains safe. Here's what Governor Sununu had to say.
We are making sure that whatever is going to happen or hopefully not happen over the next week or so, where the threats really lie, state police, National Guard, full coordination with our federal partners, we're on alert and we're ready.
Dean, what are your thoughts on protests mm-hmm. in Concord or throughout the
yeah,
state?
Yeah, you know, there has been a lot of chatter about this day of protest on the 17th. And then also we're looking to see what happens on inauguration day as well. You know, I think we're going to see activity at a number of state capitals around the country. I think all 50 states are really on some sort of elevated or high alert as a result. You know, I think in Washington, we've got something like 20,000 National Guard in there now, as Jasmine was saying, that, you know, the Capitol has been hardened from a national security perspective. It's probably going to be like, you know, let alone the pandemic, you know, you put this on top of that, it's going to be like no inauguration that we've ever seen before. But I think there is concern given some of the episodes that we've seen. Jasmine mentioned Sacramento. We also have Michigan and other places where there have been concerns. So, you know, we'll see what materializes here. I think these are intended to be, you know, open carry protests where people would be armed. And that adds another level of potential risk to anybody who wants to protest.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Andy in Hollis. Andy, thank you very much. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd like to remind everybody about President Roosevelt's four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And right now, freedom of speech seems to be under attack. We now have people who are saying that if they can't free speak, then they're not being able to speak. We now have Harvard University wanting to take away diplomas from people that graduated. But be that as it may, freedom of speech is under attack. And the other issue is, I guess, finger pointing. We only elect 537 people to lead our nation, 400 reps, 100 senators, and a president and a vice president. I say 435 reps and 100 senators and president and vice president. Shame on us Americans for not being able to elect the best people to lead our nation. So.
Sure. Andy, can I ask you about the points you made on freedom of speech? I mean, you cited a private organization, Harvard University. Twitter has also been criticized for limiting the president's speech by closing down his account for good. The government, however, does not seem to have, as far as I know, put any restriction on speech. And the president can still get his message out through videos and news conferences and whatnot. Do you see the government also cracking down on free speech?
To a certain extent, yes.
In what case?
And so, it seems to be on, we talk about free speech, let someone even talk on the newspaper, and pretty soon, or through a newspaper, and those are limited now, gee whiz, people start taking the other side immediately and not listening to people having a natural discussion.
Well, Andy, we appreciate you joining our discussion. We had to move on to our COVID-19 briefing, but I do want to thank the two guests that we've had on the program throughout this hour today. Jasmine Ulloa, national political reporter, election reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you very much for being on, Jasmine. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Glad to have you back on the program, Dean.
Thanks, Peter. My pleasure.
And because COVID-19 is such an important story this week, we would be remiss if we did not discuss it. So let's turn now to Teddy Rosenbluth. She's a healthcare reporter for the Concord Monitor and core member with Report for America. Teddy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Teddy, this past week, the country broke another sad record, more than 4,000 deaths due to COVID-19 in a single day. What has that looked like in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so over the last week, we have averaged about 750 new COVID cases a day. To put that in some perspective, in the spring, we really didn't get above 200 cases a day. So our numbers this week have gone down slightly since last week, but we're still, you know, not in a good position.
Mm-hmm. And so are there any new restrictions being considered given the rising case numbers?
You know, I haven't heard of any new restrictions being discussed. I think, you know, if we were looking to restrict restaurants and bars, you know, that should have come earlier when, you know, the virus was less widespread. Now that it's everywhere, I'm not sure, you know, how much good those restrictions would do.
Mm-hmm. And I believe the state has issued some guidance for those who have been vaccinated. What can you tell us about new guidelines for those who have received both shots of the vaccine?
Yeah, so there's some new quarantine requirements. Is that what you're referring
to?
Yeah,
if there are quarantine changes for those folks, we'd love to hear about them.
Yeah, so people who have either had COVID-19 within 90 days of being exposed to the virus or people who have been fully vaccinated no longer have to quarantine for the full time period. That was mainly to help, you know, nursing homes who have really been affected by these quarantine requirements. You know, they have staff members who are out of work for weeks if they've come in contact with the virus.
And where are we on testing? What's the turnaround time for testing?
Yeah, so testing was, you know, slowing down a little bit right before Thanksgiving. You know, a lot of people were getting tested before they went away for the holidays. Now I think we're back in a good place. On average, people with symptoms can schedule a test within a day. People with no symptoms can usually schedule a test within 48 hours. And on average, you know, the test results get back to you in 3 days. So we're actually one of the better states in terms of turnaround times for COVID tests.
Is it clear to you that we have enough tests for everybody who wants to get tested in New Hampshire?
I haven't heard of any complaints of people who want tests who haven't been able to get tests. I think turnaround time is the main limiting factor, and we seem to be doing well on that front.
Yeah. And Governor Sununu says the state is receiving doses of vaccines on a regular basis. What can you tell us about the state's receipt of vaccines? Are we getting our fair share?
Yeah, so I think right now it's interesting. They're kind of at a turning point. The federal government has said that they maybe want to change how vaccines are allocated to states. So it's no longer based on population. It's kind of an incentive-based program where the states who have been fastest at vaccinating people will get more vaccines. It's unclear, you know, whether when the administration changes that policy is going to stay in effect. But I think you know, state officials are certainly concerned about what that might mean for New Hampshire.
And what can you tell us about who is currently eligible to sign up for and receive a vaccine?
Yeah, so right now we're still in phase 1A of our vaccine rollout plan. So that includes healthcare providers, nursing home residents and staff, first responders. But at the press conference yesterday, the state officials announced that people who are in phase 1B of the vaccination plan, so that's everyone over 65, the medically vulnerable caregivers and so on, can start to sign up for their appointments to be vaccinated a week from today on Friday on the Department of Health website.
And so that was a change, right? Because it used to be everybody 75 and older, but now it's 65 and older. So more people in the older age category can get their vaccine sooner.
Yes, this is a huge change. This came after, you know, the federal guidance on vaccine distribution kind of abruptly changed on Tuesday. They asked states to kind of immediately make vaccines available to everyone 65 and older. That added about 100,000 people into phase 1B. State officials were kind of meeting frantically to figure out how to do this. And I think the main concern right now is, you know, are we going to have enough vaccines to meet the demand of this group? Because we've seen other states that have gone with this model, like California, that have really struggled to meet the demand of such a, you know, huge subsection of the population.
I want to ask you about teachers and when they get vaccinated, because we've been getting a lot of questions from teachers about, hey, we sometimes work with medically vulnerable students. A lot of us have to do our work in person. Why are teachers not moved ahead faster in the prioritization for vaccines?
Yeah, so New Hampshire is actually one of two states, the other state is New Jersey, that doesn't include teachers in the first phase of vaccination distribution. You know, the reasons that the governor has said at press conferences is that you just have to look at the people who are most vulnerable to the virus. You know, yesterday they talked about, you know, the people who are most at risk of dying of COVID-19. And he said, you know, teachers haven't made up a large subsection of that group. But I certainly think that, you know, teachers are upset, especially considering, you know, how many other states have put them in the front of the line.
Well, that's Teddy Rosenbluth. She's healthcare reporter for the Concord Monitor and core member with Report for America. Teddy, thank you very much for coming on the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to her reporting and all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by senior producer Alan Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips produced the show, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.